Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, scientists are debating whether we've moved into a new geologic epoch. For the past 11 to 12,000 years, we've been, and officially still are, in the Holocene, the time after the last ice age that have seen the ascent of human society. Now man is having such a profound influence on our planet that some geologists are proposing that we are now living in a new epoch, the Anthropocene, or the Age of Man. My guest today takes an exhaustive look at how carbon emissions over the past century is affecting atmosphere, land, water, and oceans, and how man's ability to adapt and innovate, for good and ill, is changing our environments in the mountains, deserts, rivers and streams, farmlands, and forest. Guy Events is a journalist and broadcaster specializing in science and the environment. She's been the news editor of Nature magazine, the editor of the journal Nature Climate Change, and the online editor of New Scientist. In her book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made, Vince visits nearly every continent, examining man's effect on the environment and how humans are finding innovative solutions and measures allowing local populations to survive and sometimes even thrive. Guy Events is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Guy Events, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Your book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, first of all, we should talk about this term, but what the book does is look at how the world is being affected by climate change, global warming, and while the overall news is kind of disheartening at times, what you really do point out is man has made these amazing accommodations to deal with the changing climate conditions. But first, before we let's talk a little bit about the Anthropocene. What is this? This is a new geologic era that scientists have proposed?
Yes, well, it's exactly that. So you might have heard of geological times that have gone before, such as the Jurassic or the Cretaceous, when dinosaurs ruled the world, or the Cambrian, when there was an explosion of life. Well, we're supposed to be in the Holocene at the moment, which is a time of relatively stable climate, of low human population, plentiful resources, and so on. But we have so changed our planet that it's equivalent to these big changes that have gone before, such as when the dinosaurs got wiped out by a giant asteroid. Only the big changes this time are caused by us, by humans. So the Anthropocene, it literally means the age of humans. And we are this dominant force changing everything, changing the river flows, changing the amount of ice on mountains, changing the chemistry of the oceans, the way biodiversity exists on the planet, the way landscapes look. You know, we've changed forests into farmland, and farmland is essentially a monoculture of a crop that wouldn't even exist naturally, but we've bred it over thousands of years. So everything about this planet has got a human fingerprint on it now, and the changes are so profound that they're global, they're planetary, and that's why scientists are now saying that we're entering the Anthropocene, the age of humans.
An age is pretty hard to put a date on. We're talking thousands of years to determine the date. Have scientists narrowed down when the Anthropocene actually began?
Well, I mean, this is a hotly debated topic in geological circles. In 2016, next year, the geologists are going to get together and discuss when they think this should have started. And there are some people who say, well, with the advent of farming, you know, thousands of years ago. And other people say, well, what about the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, which had this phenomenal effect, led to climate change, led to globalization and so on? Or should we take it from the great acceleration that occurred after the Second World War when population went dramatically up, when cities were built at a faster rate than ever, and we started damming every river and so on? So it is a big debated topic, and I don't know if it will be solved within the next few years or if it will take hundreds of years, like the naming of other eras and epochs have taken. The Holocene certainly took a long time. But, you know, contenders are those dates I've mentioned, and also normally when we name geological epochs, we're naming things that have gone, that have occurred in the past. So we're looking down at the rock layers, and we're finding a stripe in the rock, and we're saying, yes, we will put our marker there. It's called a golden spike. We'll put our golden spike there, and we'll say this big change is the mark between two eras starting. Well, we can't do that because the Anthropocene is happening right now among us. So it's very difficult. So we might choose a chemical signature, a certain type of plastic that's suddenly flooded everywhere. Or we might choose something like the first atomic test, you know, which led radioactive cesium to be found in the Great Lakes, in the lake beds of the Great Lakes. So, you know, we don't know exactly when it's going to start. And really, for the spirit of this book, I kind of avoided that because I'm looking at a much broader issue of these massive planetary changes that humans have made. And the exact date of when we say that this started is largely irrelevant because the beginnings and endings of eras and epochs that have gone in the past have spanned themselves thousands or hundreds of years. So it's a bit nonsensical, really, to me, to come up with a certain date.
But what your book does point out is how man has influenced every ecosystem environment on Earth. Every ecosystem has been profoundly influenced by man in some way. And in some ways, it could be a degradation of that ecosystem. In other ways, sort of a counterbalance. I mean, this is not a completely negative book. It does talk about climate change and the really frightening effects of climate change in this coming century. But you also talk about this remarkable resilience, which gets back to this idea of the Anthropocene, that man has this, well, resiliency, I guess. That is perhaps the best word to describe it.
Yes, well, that's what I'm trying to say, really, with this book, is we are incredible. We are this amazing species. We're incredibly adaptable. We're very ingenious. And the side effects and the result of this ingenuity is we are changing the planet, and in some ways for good, in some ways for ill. And really, I'm concerned about how we're changing the planet for our own species. So, you know, it might not be a very good situation for frogs at the moment because a lot of those are facing extinction. But in terms of humans, in a lot of ways, our climate change, for example, is in some ways good because we've staved off the next ice age. But then in the other hand, it's really quite bad because we're threatening our food supplies. We're threatening irrigation. We've got extreme weather events coming up. You know, it's pretty deadly for a lot of people. So really, the question is, what are we going to do about that? And I am optimistic. This is an optimistic book. I have found people through my travels, and I spent 2.5 years traveling around more than 40 countries, looking at our very many effects and looking at the bad effects and also the good effects. You know, we live twice as long as we used to. You know, we can solve all sorts of genetic and biological problems. We don't die of starvation anymore because we've invented artificial fertilizers. Our cities keep us warm, give us clean water. You know, we are pretty amazing, but we're now reaching this crisis point. And so how are we going to solve these problems? And I looked at how people already are solving the problems. You know, villages around the world, individuals, when push comes to shove, they're not waiting for some professor at Yale or Harvard to come up with a solution. You know, they have to deal with it straight away, and they are dealing with it. So it was very inspiring for me, actually.
Well, you tell the story pretty early in the book of this scientist in the very highlands of India, which is the Himalayas have been affected by climate change far greater than most. We're talking later snows, lots more droughts in the mountains where it's clear, cold, but no snow. And you tell a story of this amazing scientist who's watching the retreat of glaciers in the Himalayas and how this has a horrible effect for the farmers that depend on the runoff from those glaciers. He's created artificial glaciers.
Indeed, and he's not a scientist. He's a retired railway worker, essentially. And this is a beautiful part of our world. This is in the corner of India, Pakistan, and China, in a sort of contested zone. And it's a high altitude desert where it very rarely rains, very rarely snows. And the people there are so dependent on glaciers, these natural water storages that we have around the planet. And in the tropics, as you said, you know, they are melting faster than ever. So the big issue is that they're no longer able to irrigate their crops. They don't have drinking water, so they're all migrating. And migration is this huge problem that we're facing around the globe at the moment, where people are leaving their their villages, their culture, their traditions, their languages behind, and moving to slums in the big cities, places like Mumbai or Delhi. And this man, this railway worker, decided that he wanted to do something about this. And yes, he created artificial glaciers. I mean, it does sound incredible. It sounds impossible. And yet he did it with the most rudimentary of tools, just axes and shovels. He moved stones and rocks and created a depression in the shadow of the mountains where a glacier could form by halting the natural flow of any precipitation that did come. So it would be stopped there and it would be slowed down, so it would have a chance to freeze. Yeah. And in this way, he's managed to revive villages where people were migrating away. And because actually, because they are now able to farm again and able to grow their crops, and because the planet is also warming, they're having a sort of double whammy effect, briefly, where they're able to grow a variety of crops because of the warmer climate, and they have the meltwater from these artificial glaciers. So it's kind of boom time in these villages. I mean, I don't know how long it's going to last, because artificial glaciers, just like natural ones, can't last indefinitely as the climate warms. You know, but it's giving them some sort of breathing space. It's giving them a chance to stay a little bit longer in the home of their ancestors.
And what's really amazing about this artificial glacier, it's really more like a very large cistern that freezes, and then it releases water as it melts in the summer when that water is needed for irrigation.
Yeah, it's so clever. It's completely perfect in terms of timing, location, everything. It's ingenious. It really is ingenious. And if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed such a thing could be possible.
What you do in the book, Adventures in the Anthropocene, is sort of look at every ecosystem. That was in the mountains section. There's a section on oceans, rivers, farmlands, deserts, savannas, forests, the rocks. And I think this was in the mountain section, but it was the most crazy idea how people are coping with climate change, where snows are not happening or the rainfall patterns are changing. I think this is in Peru, I believe. They're taking their dark-colored mountains and painting them white.
Well, indeed. So, yes, in Ladakh, in northern India, they're making the artificial glaciers. In Peru, they suffer exactly the same problem. The Andes, the glaciers on the Andes are melting incredibly rapidly. It's a huge problem because the coastal cities there, the deserts, they're essentially deserts. You know, Lima, the capital of Peru, it is a desert. So they rely entirely on the meltwater from the Andes. And when these glaciers disappear, it's a disaster. And I visited this village high up, and it was a village where they rear alpaca, the camelid, you know, of South America. And the pastures there, the alpaca pastures, depend entirely on glacier meltwater. And now that the glaciers are disappearing, they again are migrating to slums outside of Lima or whichever city. So the idea there that they've had is to paint the black rock white, because the problem is glaciers already reflect an enormous amount of heat from the sun because they're white, they're very reflective. But once they start melting, they reveal the black rock underneath. And the black rock absorbs the heat and then speeds up the melting. So you get this kind of runaway effect when melting just occurs really rapidly towards the end. So what they thought they'd do is paint the rock white as though there was a glacier on it. So it's reflecting the sun's energy a lot. And then anything that falls on it won't get heated up by the rock absorbing the sun's energy. It will be allowed to rest there and it will freeze. And then because it's cold and because it's reflective, more meltwater, more precipitation will land on it and freeze, and a glacier will eventually build up. That's the idea. So I went there, and it's very high up. It's above 5,000 meters. So, you know, it's quite breathless work for me to climb up these places. And for me, I was literally climbing up to have a look. These two guys from the village were climbing up with enormous buckets full of homemade paint, which they were then throwing on the black rock and painting it white. And they painted quite a considerable amount of it white by the time I visited them. And the idea then was that they were going to use a wind turbine to little windmill to pump water up over the rock, and then it would trickle down and freeze as it went down. And apparently they have already got some sort of ice sheet forming, which melts by about 10 a.m. in the morning. But what they hope is that this is going to build up and they will have a glacier there. I mean, who knows? It sounds completely crazy to me and fairly impractical because, you know, what are we going to do, paint the whole of the Andean chain white? I mean, it's just crazy. But then I think it's a mark of just how desperate people are. You know, these changes that we're creating, this warming of the planet, it's really affecting people, and it's a really profound difficulty because it's changing the geography of the landscape. It's changing the way we are able to live and the resources that we have around us. You know, once the glaciers melt because it's too warm, that means there's no water, which means there's nowhere for the alpaca to eat. You know, what happens next? And the village dies. That type of farming dies with it. We're changing the planet. Culturally, geographically, geologically, in every way.
And architecturally, in that same section you tell about the deserts of Almeria, Spain, where they've put up tons of greenhouses there, and it's actually had an effect on climate because those greenhouses are reflecting so much of the sun's energy back. Actually, that area is cooler today because of the greenhouse. And they've also...
Indeed, it's a type of geoengineering. I mean, this is all geoengineering. When we think of geoengineering, we maybe think of these big, scary experiments planned to cool the climate or warm the climate or whatever. What we're doing now is localized or planetary geoengineering. So yes, I mean, if you go to Almeria in southern Spain, it's quite strange. It's where the spaghetti westerns were filmed.
Right.
So it's a desert landscape essentially. But when you drive through it, it looks like plastic bag land because it's just landscapes covered in plastic sheeting for these greenhouses, and it's where the majority of the vegetables, the salad vegetables and so on, are grown in Europe, in this place. It's this massive agricultural landscape, and it's all grown hydroponically. You know, they're not grown in the desert soil. It's all a sort of internal system. You know, perhaps this is how farming will be in the future. But the result of this, because it's so reflective, is it's, as you say, it's bouncing back the sun's energy, and it's having a local cooling effect. Incredible. When you think of the greenhouse effect, you think of how it's warming the earth, and it's basically doing the opposite in Almeria.
Mm. My guest today is Gaia Vince, a science and environmental journalist. Her book is titled Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. It's published by Milkweed. And in it, she looks at a variety of the large ecosystems or natural systems on the planet and looks at how climate change is affecting those various large systems and how man is adapting those systems for his own benefit and also to, at times, at least try to combat the effects of climate change. Your first section is about atmospheres, and you tell this wonderful story about cyberspace, actually, in Nepal about this amazing guy named Mahabir Poon, I believe, who's got all of a sudden these really incredibly rural villages wired up with internet. And then you start talking about the atmospheric brown cloud that is a part of a large part of that Asian continent where you have incredibly polluted conditions. And at the same time, even some small incremental changes could make a huge difference in that atmospheric brown cloud. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So we are having a massive effect on our planet, but let's not forget the atmosphere, these air that we live in, essentially, from the ground up to space, that enormous big ocean of air. That's a really important part of our technological life. So you were talking about Mahabir Poon, who he sort of sidestepped the whole developmental problem that's going on in Nepal at the moment, because Nepal's pretty much closed down, broken state. They've had coups after coup after insurgency, all sorts of problems, and they haven't developed properly like their neighbors in India and China, where development is going at a rapid pace. Nepal is kind of frozen in time, and so even to get a telephone connection is a problem. So what people have done out there, this one guy has used Wi-Fi, home Wi-Fi kits from the United States that were donated. Well, they were smuggled in because they weren't even allowed to be brought in. And doing that, he's managed to connect these incredibly remote villages in the mountains with each other and with Kathmandu, and from Kathmandu to the rest of the world. So it's especially amazing when you think that the Wi-Fi in my kitchen quite often can't be reached from my bedroom by my phone. And he's managing to do this across thousands of kilometers. But anyway, and that's one use. That's one use of the atmosphere that which we're exploiting in this remarkable and incredible way. And it's bringing connectivity. It's bringing people together. And once people come together, ideas spread, and we find solutions to problems. So the other thing you were talking about is this Asian brown cloud, and it's the pollution cause that sort of hangs over the region. And you can see it, you can breathe it, you can smell it. It's really disgusting. And it's the result of bad fires of unburnt fuel and, wet fuel. So it's the result of millions of dung fires, cow dung fires, or wet wood or whatever people are burning in very poor places. It often on little fires in a room with no chimney, and it's incredibly bad for people's health, and it's really bad for the environment as well, because it's changing the climate, the local and regional climate, just as much, if not more, than global climate change effects of carbon dioxide emitted by coal-fired power stations. So it's a really big problem. But the good thing is it's a really quite an easy problem to solve. And we're doing that across the world. We used to have this problem in the cities of America and the cities of Europe. We don't have it anymore because we use chimneys, because we use cleaner fuels, because we have modern, better power stations and better cleaner car engines and so on. So this is a problem we know how to solve, and we can do relatively quickly, and it could make a huge impact, not just to health, but also to when and where the monsoon falls.
Right. You're right that the for about the 500 million households that use open fires for cooking, a $30 clean cook stove over those 500 million households, $15 billion sounds like an incredible lot of money, but you would reduce the air pollution by what, 40% to 50%?
Yeah, it would have a phenomenal effect. And when you think that the people suffering the most from this are the women who are crouching over that, and the children, you're affecting the health of a massive population at the same time. At the same time as also improving things like where the monsoon falls and when, the reliability of things like that, you would also have this massive, massive health benefit, which improves development.
And the brown cloud is having an effect on agriculture as well as human health. When you think of like Shanghai and Beijing, and especially Beijing, the dirty air and the number of loss of life from that dirty air. But you look at someplace like India, which depends on growing rice and you're looking at yields down by 20% to 25%. It's attributed to this brown cloud.
Yeah, exactly. It's because it alters monsoon patterns. Mm-hmm. It causes a climate change, which alters monsoon patterns, and so they don't get the irrigation. And so then they have massive harvest failures. It's a really, really big problem, and it's affecting millions of people. And I think it's been a bit on the back burner, excuse the pun, while people have been concentrating on other causes of climate change. And, it is one that is relatively easy to address. It's not about completely changing the whole of our technological economic system from a fossil fuel economy to a renewables economy, which is a really hard task and which the world is very slow to do, but is making some progress on. This is something that's relatively easy to achieve. So I hope it's happening. I mean, already what's happening in China, for example, is the big cities are cleaning up. You know, Shanghai now is a lot cleaner than it was just 5 years ago. But that means that the industry has just moved further inland to another place, to another poor city, right. which is becoming really filthy. What we need to do is a proper root cause change. And it needs to be done fairly urgently, yeah.
My guest today is Gaia Vince. She's the author of Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. In our last couple of minutes, let's talk about oceans, because when people think of climate change and they think of rising sea levels, they think of coastal areas. And you went to the Maldives, which is one of those places, unfortunately, we think of when we think of rising sea levels. You know, the highest point in all of the islands is maybe 7-8 feet above sea level. What they're doing to deal with this, they're building artificial islands. And one of the most interesting sort of workarounds, if you will, over this is, you know, coral reefs are such an important part of these tropical islands and how they withstand storms and withstand flooding from storms. And they come up with what they call biorock structures to stimulate the growth of coral. This is amazing. They're getting amazing results. Can you talk about the biorock structures?
Well, yes. So coral dissolves in acidic waters, essentially. And the Maldives is a coral atoll. It's made of coral. Instead of it being rock underneath the ground, it's coral. So as the oceans become more acidic, and they become more acidic when they dissolve carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, coral dies and it gets dissolved away. So this is a problem. It's exacerbated by warmer waters and pollution and other things. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to create artificial corals by stimulating the water electrically through this. It's a kind of porous concrete-y thing that was rigged up with an electric current, and the corals kind of migrate to it. They love it. They find it irresistible, and they start clustering around it, and they grow. And these structures are really beautiful because coral reefs are some of the most beautiful ecosystems on the planet. You know, they're essential fish nurseries, but they support such a wide variety of colorful, beautiful marine life. And really extraordinary things, you know, from fan starfish to a huge variety of different organisms. So this is one way that scientists hope that we might be able to regenerate coral. Whether it's successful on a larger scale, I don't know. A lot of these things have only been tried on small scales. So, but the problem is planetary. You know, the problem is this huge global thing. So we have to start small and see what works and then scale up. That's the idea.
Gaia Vince, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Science journalist Gaia Vince speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She is the author of Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made. It's published by Milkweed Editions. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.